Biological Parasite by Eustace Mullins, Part 6. Although I live in joy and peace, I know that America must be restored to Christ. I would like to free her from her bondage to Satan in the metaphysical sphere, and from her bondage to the Jews in the biological sphere. Although I have been freed from suffering through knowing Christ, I know what suffering is doing to my people, who have been robbed of everything, and who have been converted into mindless robots who mechanically perform tasks according to instructions implanted in them by a Jewish programming, and who respond to every question with a Jewish answer. I resent the fact that my nation and my people have been converted into a country of Pavlov-conditioned dogs, and I am resolved to see them become men once more, because they are cut off from the creative life, because they are cut off from the life of their nation by the Jewish parasite. Their lives are empty and pointless. One of the problems of this Pavlov conditioning is that we no longer have heroes. Now, a nation cannot grow in health without heroes. For the past 50 years, our heroes have been the synthetic products of Jewish liberalism, those Americans who have successfully exploited their people for the benefit of the Jews, and who have expedited the mongrelization of the American people. These synthetic heroes are made of plastic. They do not have any of the human qualities. A typical synthetic hero is Hubert Humphrey, Vice President of the United States, whom one can press into any shape, like a rubber doll, because he has no skeletal structure. He has accepted every aspect of the Chavez Goy rule, and he has no culture and no goals except those which have been implanted in him by the Jewish programmers. In 1957, alarmed by the issuance of a report known as the Gaither Report, which insisted that every aspect of Chavez Goy life and Jewish liberalism must be intensified in America, some of my associates urged me to make a formal reply. As this request dovetailed with some projects on which I was then engaged, I was able to draw up a sweeping reply within a few weeks. This report is reproduced here, exactly as it was published in August 1957 by M&N Associates in Chicago, Illinois. Due to public alarm over the Gaither Report, which admits that the United States is rapidly becoming a second-class power, but dares not admit why that is inevitable, M&N Associates has decided to release the confidential Mullins Report, prepared in August 1957 for a group of American industrialists. We issue this report as a public service, by an impartial research organization. It has already become history. By 1980, the United States will occupy the same position in international affairs as does India today. The United States will then be an overpopulated, impoverished country, with a standard of living 50 cents below its 1957 level. Consequently, there is no need and little possibility of Russia waging war against the United States. The rapid wane of the United States as a global power will enable Russia to make the American continents into communist satellites by 1980, if she so chooses, but this prospect is unlikely. From geopolitical considerations, the continents of North and South America will be of little practical use to Russia. Her European and Asian policies will remain paramount to her national security, but the American continents will be of less geopolitical significance than Africa. Because of this prospect, the Rockefeller Report and other government demands for increased defense spending may be properly evaluated as last-gasp attempts to shore up an artificial and doomed prosperity. How did it happen that the United States, which in 1945 stood unchallenged as the supreme world power, could decline so rapidly? To understand this, a brief review of the nation's history is necessary. The country was settled by bold, energetic North Europeans who were willing to risk their lives in a wilderness in order to own their own homes and land. Cheap labour was needed, but the Indians refused to become menials, so they were killed or put on reservations. The New Englanders imported Negroes, but they proved to be less productive than the cost of their keep, so they were sold to southern plantation owners, where the climate was more suitable and their owners less demanding. Even so, their importation was soon discontinued as impractical. Meanwhile, the original North European settlers prospered and increased. With ample space and plenty of natural resources, they soon developed into the most highly skilled and productive people that the world has ever known. New inventions poured from them, and they enjoyed the greatest prosperity in the history of mankind. Successive waves of cheap labour came from Europe. A substantial wave from Ireland produced many desirable citizens, but after 1860, little further immigration came from Northern Europe. Most of it was from Central and Southern Europe, with some Asiatics. Side by side with the North European settlers lived the burgeoning families of the darker citizens, limited in number in their own lands because of their lower productivity. They reproduced in much greater numbers here because of the higher productivity of their hosts. Despite the fact that these darker citizens enjoyed a higher standard of living here, thanks to the superior technology of the North Europeans, they felt no gratitude. Instead, they were consumed by hatred and envy of the North Europeans, many of whom had amassed large fortunes and lived like princes. By 1900, the darker American citizens had formed a voting bloc to combat the political leadership of the North Europeans. Already, a deep racial schism had formed, which doomed the young republic at the very peak of its promise. The North Europeans soon concentrated their strength in the Republican Party, while the darker citizens became Democrats, a party which also represented the white Southerners as a result of the war between the states. This strange alliance achieved its first great political victory in 1912 with the election of Woodrow Wilson, a misguided idealist who hailed the Russian Communist Revolution of 1917 as a victory for democracy over the forces of despotism. Wilson set the nation on a suicidal foreign policy caused by the racial schism of its people. This policy aimed to end all racial injustice, atone for the sins of British imperialism, reprimand French imperialism, stop German imperialism, and set up a worldwide protectorate for the coloured peoples. The North European Americans had no idea what this policy intended and were too busy and prosperous to care. The nation gained in wealth and power by entering the First World War. A few years later, the crash of 1929 wiped out the fortunes and the property of more than half of the North European Americans. The stage was set for the Roosevelt regime, which was to set up the rule of the darker citizens over the impoverished and dispirited white Americans, a rule carried on by the Truman and Eisenhower directorates. Our entry into the Second World War was intended to stop racist Germany, as though every group in the world was not racist and interested in its own self-aggrandizement. In 1945, a victorious United States reaffirmed its role as the protector of the colored world, but Soviet Russia also claimed to be the protector of the colored world and pointed out that white Americans refused to intermarry with the darker citizens. Most white Americans maintained homogeneous communities, schools, clubs, and places of worship, just as did all other groups in the United States. However, the heirs of the Roosevelt regime now ruled it illegal for white Americans to separate themselves, although all other groups were allowed to do so without hindrance by the government. Now, the government began to enforce a policy of racial amalgamation, although no other nation in the world, especially Soviet Russia, followed such a policy. Largely through the Supreme Court, an instrument operating upon powers usurped from Congress, white Americans were stripped of their private institutions and forced into racially integrated schools and living quarters. Intermarriage was inevitable, particularly because of the flood of integration propaganda. All religious groups in the United States declared it a religious duty to racially amalgamate, although not one of their leaders could cite a single tenet of dogma which required this. White children were taught in the schools and the churches that it was their duty to intermarry with the darker citizens, and the press, radio, television, and movies pressed the mongrelization campaign. The government continued legal action against the last privacies of white citizens, although no action was taken against Negro, Jewish, or other group institutions. Yet at the very moment that white Americans were being forced to racially amalgamate, their technical skills were in greater demand than ever before. Guided missiles were being developed by imported German scientists because impoverished white Americans were working as manual laborers, unable to educate their children in technical schools. But the shortage of engineers was laid to the fact that we had not availed ourselves of our fine Negro talents, a people who squatted in dusty jungle kraals for 20,000 years without the least improvement in their conditions, was now declared the rightful heirs of the American technology. Our universities were flooded with colored students, their tuition paid by government grants and racist foundations for coloreds only. The white Americans, who could have salvaged our declining technology, continued as manual laborers. All of this was inevitable. The Americans of North European descent, although realizing that he possessed superior skills, bore no ill will towards the darker citizens. But the colored man could not see a white man without hating him, for the white face reminded the colored man that he was dark. Either the colored man must become lighter, or the white man must become darker. No other remedy would pacify him. Anyone who has seen the advertisements for skin whiteners in the Negro press knows how basic this drive is among the dark people. The pivotal Negro vote caused the white man to be legislated out of existence in the nation which he had created, and the Supreme Court declared, quote, "all Americans are Negroes," close quote. M&N Associates makes no comment on the justice or injustice of this development. We only evaluate the facts. The inevitable result was that by destroying the white American's desire to preserve himself as a manifestation of God's holy will, and forcing him to intermarry with the coloured, the nation was condemned to go the way of other great world powers, India, Egypt, Greece, and Rome, whose white leadership vanished in intermarriage with darker peoples. The passing of a great nation from the stage of world history is neither an occasion for sadness or rejoicing. It is simply an historical event. The process was bound to be much more rapid in the United States because of the pace of modern life and the tremendous pressure behind the dark people's will to intermarry with the whites. At the same time, Soviet Russia's white managerial elite showed no intention of intermarrying with darker peoples, and it continued to specialize. Selective breeding became a state policy, and thus Russia secured the future for herself, for the future was long since known to belong to that nation which could produce the highest type of technological elite. At this late stage, M&N Associates was asked to ascertain whether the coloured citizens could be restrained in their aggression against white Americans. The answer is no. They will never be content to enjoy their higher standard of living here because it cannot compensate for their constant reminders to themselves that they are inferiors. Once again, bolder whites will emigrate, this time to Australia and New Zealand. At best, the United States may become a sort of British Guiana, a coloured colony of white Canada, whose dollar is already worth more than ours. It is too late for the North European stock, a minority of 50 million, to reassert leadership over 120 million mixed bloods. The coloured cannot be appealed to on patriotic grounds, for they can never know nation feeling, but only have race. Only a people capable of defending their land can know patriotism. Typical was A. Philip Randolph's advice to Negroes to refuse to serve in the U.S. Army. M&N Associates does not believe that a white movement could gain power. There is no longer a white market in the U.S., either commercially or politically. At best, the whites might secede again as a white southern republic, leaving the mulatto north to go its own way, but the result would be the same: the disappearance of the United States as a world power. Our mulatto grandchildren will placidly watch the decay of the nation they inherited, while the rest of the world, including Soviet Russia, pay no more attention to us than is presently paid to the mouthings of the mulatto inhabitants of India. The world is realistic.
You're tuned in to Radio Stormer on the DailyStormer.com.
When that report was drawn up more than a decade ago, I said that it was already history. Since then, the American position has worsened on the precise lines which I had laid down. I said there was no white market, and every American politician since then has borne me out. In only one point did I err. I failed to allow for the possible reclamation of America through knowing Christ, because at that time I had not progressed this far. I did not foresee this sole possibility of reclamation for America. Some of the sponsors of this report felt that it was unduly pessimistic. Yet in less than a decade, many of our great cities, including the nation's capital, lay in ashes, while we had entered an economic crisis which seemed impossible to solve. Now, even the Mullins report did not predict national bankruptcy against a background of burned and looted cities in less than 10 years. Who will dare to be sufficiently pessimistic about the next 10 years? Let us recapitulate how this all came about. In 1945, the United States stood alone as a supreme military power in the world, the only industrial nation whose plants had not been destroyed by the Second World War. Militarily and economically, America was the master of the world, and the world waited for our command. We had only to raise our hand, and our command would be obeyed. England, France, Italy, Russia and Germany, and in Asia, Japan, lay in ruins, their factories but heaps of rubble. But we gave no command. Why? Because the parasites and their shabezgoy wretches had but one desire, to rebuild communist Russia. Dean Acheson proposed that vast new loans be made to Russia through his law firm, Covington and Burling, which so ably represented 9 communist nations at our federal trough. The American post-war economy was hamstrung by communist Jews such as David Niles, a notorious homosexual, who bragged that Harry Truman never made a decision without consulting him, and who had one sister in Israeli intelligence in Tel Aviv and another sister high in the Soviet intelligence in Moscow. Harry Dexter White, a Lithuanian Jew and lifelong communist agent, also supervised Truman's decisions as President of the United States. At the top of this heap of worms squirmed the master parasite, Bernard Baruch, an agile Jewish speculator who made as much as $1 million a day through foreknowledge of government decisions which affected the stock market. No wonder Harry Truman called Bernard Baruch the greatest living American. This master parasite pulled the strings of a horde of conniving political wretches and collected United States senators as a lesser man might net a cageful of hamsters. He publicly boasted that he had such senators as Harry Byrd, James Burns, Harry Truman, and many others in his pocket. Now, America's conversion to a peacetime economy was held up by these Jews in order to give Russia precious time to rebuild her shattered economy. Not only was the United States paralyzed by Jewish economic planners whose sole aim was to stall the erection of a prosperous economy, but the communists also found the ideal instrument with which to weaken America from within, a planned race war. With the race war and the paralyzed economy in America, the communists bought time, a precious decade, for Russia to build an atomic bomb with the assistance of the Rosenbergs and a vast horde of Jewish spies, while other agents threw the Negro masses against the barricades in a reckless and destructive race war. Now, the government of the United States practically ceased to function as the spontaneous and carefully rehearsed demand of the Negro people for their civil rights took precedence over everything else in Washington. The shabezgoy wretches leapt into the fray on the side of the Negroes, yelping with precise responses to every command of the Jewish parasite, their paws flailing the air as they slavered for their slice of raw steak. Whenever the Jews called out civil rights or peace, As the high priests of the Shabbos Goy wretches, the Supreme Court gave official status to every demand of the communist-inspired mobs in 1954, when it ruled that all schools must be integrated. No other single decision of the Supreme Court has ever plunged the nation into such chaos. Americans stood appalled as armies of American soldiers marched into American cities, bayoneting and shooting white citizens who tried to claim their rights. But a decade later, when we saw American soldiers again marching into American cities, it was to protect the Negro mobs who were looting and burning with impunity. Now, in 1945, as we have mentioned, the United States stood preeminent in the world as the new Rome. But in 1955, Russia was well on her way towards re-establishing herself as a world power, while the United States was weaker than it had been in 1945. And in 1965, the pendulum had already swung in favour of Russia, for in this decade the Soviet agents had successfully implemented a full-scale race war in the United States and had also succeeded in committing American soldiers to the endless holocaust of an Asiatic land war, caught in a man-for-man struggle. With Asia's teeming billions, the United States would slowly bleed to death, while Russia daily grew stronger without losing a man. And Russia, at home, was calm, while the United States was drawn into a race war. The government was paralyzed, the education system was paralyzed, and the American people had not a single representative who would defend their interests. Jewish gold had purchased the sorriest lot of ragtail beggars and thieves that had ever infested our nation's capital. Men who, while handing over billions to the Jews, had sold themselves for a paltry few thousand dollars apiece. Our senators and representatives did not even ask for their souls, the price of a healthy Negro slave at pre-Civil War levels. The Mullins Report, in placing a dateline of 1980 to see the United States reduced to the status of another India, had erred by 10 years. Now, it seems that 1970 is a far more likely date.